your feet, head bowed and eyes closed.
I've got to thank God more for any other thing outside of my salvation. I've got to thank Him for the privilege of being a preacher's kid. Over the country, you hear so many people griping because they're PKs. They say, well, I can't do so-and-so, and I can't have any fun because I'm a preacher's kid. It never bothered me. Brother, let me tell you something. It was such a thrill to be Bob Shuler's son. You say, now, why do you say that? Well, very easily. He was one of a kind. There's no doubt in my mind that God made my father from the dust of the earth, but when He did, He threw in a double handful of gravel. He was a different kind of a man. Dad came out of Texas. He had three charges in Texas. One was in Temple, Texas. One was in Paris, Texas. One was in Austin, Texas. In Temple, Texas, he found out by a man that came to him and told him there were one-armed bandits down at the bottom of the Moose Lodge, that he had lost all his money gambling on the silver dollar one-armed bandit. Dad realized that there was no ability, there's no way you could gamble in Texas in that particular county. It had been outlawed, so he knew somebody was breaking the law. He found out that the mayor of that town owned those gambling devices, 21 armed bandits at the bottom of the Moose Lodge. So Dad got up and he announced that to his congregation, and he said that that man should be run out of town. He was a mayor and he's a man supposed to be respected as the leader of law and order. They should run him out of town, and they did. And in those days, they didn't ask him to leave. They tarred and feathered the general. Ran him out on a rail. When Dad went back to the General Conference of Texas, the bishop said, Shuler, we didn't have in mind for you to run Texans out of their offices. We don't want you to run mayors out. We don't want you to stir up the waters. We want you to keep the waters calm. In the Methodist Church, my dear brother, he said, we don't have any ripples in the water. Cut it out. Stand with one foot north and one foot west and just speak to the people. Don't stir them up. So they sent him to Paris, Texas. Dad got into Paris, Texas. The first thing he did was look up the mayor. Examine him. And he found out the mayor was not guilty of gambling, but he had done a marvelous thing. He had paid off an $18,000 mortgage in 2 years on a $3,000 salary. That's pretty good, even using old math. Dad got to snooping around in the book of records and found out that he owned 5 houses. You say, well, now, that's not bad. You don't know, nothing wrong with owning houses. Well, these happened to be houses of prostitution. He had the prostitution racket signed up. So Dad did this up brown. Dad hired an auditorium, put an ad in the paper. He's going to run the mayor out of town. And they jammed this auditorium out. Dad came out 5 minutes late. Dad was never late unless he wanted to be late, unless it was for emphasis. That place was jammed and packed, and everybody was just sitting around waiting for my father to come. Dad walked on with his dungarees, an old dirty shirt, hayseed around his neck, sweaty hat on, shoes dirty. He come right from slopping the hogs and milking the cows, right from chores. He had a sheaf of papers in his hand. He walked out, and the people, especially his members, you know, they're kind of high-fluting. They all went, ooh, you know, some of them smelt the shoes, you know. And Dad stopped right in the middle of the platform and said, oh. He said, you're shocked at my attire? He said, well, my old daddy taught me when I had to skin a skunk to dress for it. And he took off on that mayor. That mayor is sitting right in front of him with his whole entourage. Dad gave him 50 minutes of buckshot, brother. And then when he was through, he said, now I've told what I want to say. Now, Mayor, you've got the platform for 50 minutes. Get up here and rebut this, if you will. Mayor turned with his crowd, walked out the side door. Dad said, somebody close. Dad was right after it. When he walked outside, Spencer, his old printer, was with him, and some of the members of his board of trustees. Dad walked outside near that mayor and pulled out a Colt 44, old hog leg. And he said, Shuler, I'm going to kill you. He said, I'm going to kill you. You've ruined me politically. He said, I'm going to kill you. And Dad said, well, Mayor, he said, I'm going to give you every opportunity to kill me. He said, I'm going to walk down that alley and give you the broad of my back. He said, I think you'd rather shoot me in the back than in the face. You're that kind of a man. But he said, I'll tell you this, Mayor, if you don't shoot straight and kill me, I'm coming after you tonight. I'm getting a shotgun and coming after you. One of us will go. We're going to leave town tonight. Spencer said, Phil, I've stood by your daddy for over 50 years, but that night I stood as far from him as I possibly could. And he said, even then I was in jeopardy more than your dad. He said, that guy couldn't get his gun straight. He was so mad. And your dad walked with resolution, didn't speed up at all, walked slowly by himself down that alley. When he turned that alley, he sprinted as hard as he could run. And the whole board now was after that. Dad got to the house, pulled out his old squirrel rifle, the old 12-gauge, with 8 shot in it, and he loaded his pockets with black powder and shells, and he went to the mayor's beautiful mansion on the hill. The board was saying, Shuler, give us the gun. He said, get out of here. He said, Mayor, come out here. A window shade moved a little bit, so Dad just blew the window out. He went around, Spencer said, blew every window of that house out. Next morning, there were wagon tracks pulled up there. What he could get, he took. Never heard of that mayor again. He took off for parts unknown. Probably skipped over into a foreign country, Oklahoma. To a Texan, it is. Next annual conference, my dad was on the floor. All the bishops were tearing their fingernails out, ripping their hair out. They said, Shuler, don't do this to us. We want you to be a peaceable man. So the bishop of the Methodist Church came. His name was Smith, Will Smith. He came up to my dad and he said, Shuler, I hate like smoke to do this for you. But he said, I've got to send you to the second largest Methodist charge in the state of Texas. Dad said, why am I getting that plum? He said, because the mayor of Austin, Texas is the chairman of the board of trustees and we know he's honest and he's the only one in Texas we do know is honest. So I said, we're sending you in a town that's got an honest mayor. You can't run him out. And Dad got into that church. And brother, let me tell you something. He and the mayor became fast friends. And Dad got to snooping in the state house and found out that Governor Ferguson had absconded with $32,000 worth of funds. And Dad led the impeachment of Governor Ferguson. And they impeached him. And old Ma Ferguson, M.A. Ferguson, ran Texas for a term. Of course, the mayor kind of pulled the strings. State of Texas has been under a Lone Star flag, a Spanish flag, and a petticoat that I know of. Well, when that 4 years was over, they had it with my dad. And when Texans have it, you know you've gone too far. When you're too hot for Texas, you're just too hot. So they made a deal with the California-Arizona Conference to send my dad to California and swapped him for an old superannuate that was about to retire just to get him out of there. And with the swap, they sent a wire to Bishop Baker of the Methodist Church, California-Arizona Conference, and the wire had 2 words in it. We happened to have it in our scrapbook at home. We happened to get it. It said, bury Shuler. Now, how are you going to bury a man that God's hands upon? How are you going to bury a man that preaches like a fellow falling out of a window? Well, you try to put him into a church of 2,800 people that only have 92 active members. That's how you bury him. You put him into a great big auditorium, they had a little few people rattling around in there. So that's what they did. They sent him to Trinity Methodist Church, a great old church of the past that had put 2 bishops in the Methodist Church. But now, 92 people out of about, oh, maybe 400 or 500 members, 92 that were attending. It was a dead church. But God had gone before my father and had impressed a woman in San Francisco by the name of Glide. A woman that happened to have a little bit of money. Fact of the matter is, she had 3 hotels and about 150 oil wells. And she had a memorial fund that put boys through Asbury Seminary without any tuition. She paid their way. And she heard that the Methodist Church was after this fighting fundamentalist. And she sneaked out one day with some petty cash that she had, and she purchased a 500-watt radio station. KGEF. And she sold it to my daddy for $1. Dad was in business. Dad got there, boy, I tell you, he had a voice. Traveled all over Los Angeles. Only other station larger was KFI at that time. Well, on the second Tuesday after my father got there, the Los Angeles Times building was blown up. All the presses were dynamited and spiked. The whole thing was gone. Dad had a lawyer that was also the head of his Sunday school. By the way, he's a Presbyterian. My dad was quite a man. He had a Presbyterian Sunday school superintendent for 32 years. No wonder all of us that came out of there were Baptists. You mix Presbyterianism with Methodism and you get a Baptist, you know. And Dad said, how can I flush out William Randolph Hearst? He said, I know he's a scoundrel. And undoubtedly, he had something to do with this, his only competitor being out of business. How can I flush him out? Tom Bunn, the lawyer, said, well, you put that in a rhetoric statement and you can't be sued. He said, now, if you get up and say, my opinion is that William Randolph Hearst knows something about this, he can sue you for slander. But if you get up and put it in a question, he can't sue you. Did you know that? It's true. So next time your mother-in-law comes and you want to insult her, ask her a question. You can't be sued that way. So Dad got up and he said, now there's only one newspaper in Los Angeles, actually two, the Morning Herald Express, the Evening Examiner. He says, only two papers owned by the same man. William Randolph Hearst. He said, now that means he has no competitor. I wonder if William Randolph Hearst knows who dynamited the Times building. Well, my dad's whole theory was this. Number one, if you shoot a shotgun into a pack of dogs, the one that's hit will howl. Isn't that simple? Always works. And the second thing was, if you shoot a gun in a hole long enough, something's bound to come out if it's there. It can't take it after a while. Just keep after a thing and it can't take it. Some of you parents know about that. When your kid comes and says, I want a nickel, I want a nickel. The ice cream man's going by. I want a nickel, I want a nickel, I want a nickel. Pretty soon, here's a dollar, kid, get out of here. Shoot in a hole long enough, something's bound to come out. All right. Here, Dad got up and shot a shotgun into a pack of dogs, and the one that hit howled in a two-column editorial all the way down the front of the morning paper, Schuler, go back to Texas. And in that was everything Dad ever did in Texas, plus a whole slew of things he never got around to doing that he wanted to do. It was all in the paper, and the fight was on. Dad would blast away from the radio. Hearst would blast away from the editorial. Sure, Hearst sold a few more papers, but here came the people to Dad's church. Why, folks, listen. The common people of Los Angeles said there's a young Methodist preacher standing on his hind legs, defying City Hall and the big people in this country. Say, let's support him. Let's get behind him. Within a year, we had 1,200 people attending. Within 3 years, that place was packed. You couldn't get a seat. We had to enlarge the auditorium, put 400 extra seats up in the balcony. Now, a certain newspaper publisher, whom I will not name, for I do not want to hurt the family, took a $50,000 contract out on my dad. Took it out with Al Capone, Murder Incorporated in Chicago, Illinois, who then transferred the Scarlet Hand Gang into Los Angeles County under Babyface Nelson. And those three thugs, we knew them well after a while, those three hitmen did everything that was humanly possible by hitmen to kill my dad for 11 years and couldn't kill him. I cannot go into all that they did. Naturally, you understand that. I don't have the time. But let me give you a kind of a rundown on it. His church was bombed twice. Both times his whole complete office was blown off the side of his church. Very heavy time bomb. Both time bombs were set during the time my dad usually dictated letters on Wednesday afternoon. Dad was a victim of habit. He had a ritual. He went through certain schedules. And both of these times were those odd times that Dad quit dictating and said, Miss Osborne, let's just put down our work a while. I feel like a cup of coffee. I want a cup of coffee. And they go out to get a cup of coffee. Kahoom, church is blown up. Someone said to me not too long ago, he says, you shouldn't drink coffee. It stunts your health. Well, it saved Dad's twice. We had Uncle Bud Robinson one time with us, you know, and he's a Nazarene. We had some holiness people come to visit him. And he was sitting there with my dad stirring a cup of coffee, and a woman came by with the bun on the back of her head, and she went, ooh. She said, Uncle Bud, how can you drink coffee and be a Christian? Bud said, very simple, woman. You just put your finger in the cup and lift it and sip. which I thought was a good answer. The house was machine gunned once. My dad was just about to put District Attorney Keyes in prison, which he did. He's the one that had the Amy Simple McPherson case. My dad put him into prison. By the way, he got saved in prison. He's a Baptist preacher today. But Dad was after District Attorney Keyes. And this Scarlet Hand gang wrote and said, "We're coming by your house at such a time. Going to machine gun it for what you said about Keyes." Well, you say, "Why didn't you call the police?" Dad had just got through putting the chief of police of Los Angeles into prison. He had 11 court cases in which he put 9 officials into prison and 8 multimillionaires. This was his hobby. He preached. No, this is true. He preached effectively for souls, but he was a cleanup man. He was a cleanup man. And he cleaned up Los Angeles. He just put the chief of police into prison on graft, so there's no sense calling the police. They'd just load those boys' guns for him, you know. So Dad said, "We'll protect our own house." So he sent the boys out on the horses and got what they could in the ways of shotguns. And Dad gave me a .410. Boy, I'll never forget that. I was just 5 years of age. Think of that, 5 years of age. Dad gave me a .410. And a double barrel, old Damascus barrel, had the hammers on it, you know. And old black powder shells, he put them in there for me. He said, "Now, son, when you shoot, just let them happen." Man, I was so excited. I got up on the roof, you know, and I lay down there waiting for these people to come. Ed, my scoundrel brother, who now is the favorite of the whole family as far as I'm concerned, Ed leaned over, and Ed was 6 1/2 at this time. He's real smart, you know. He leaned over and he said, "Pete," he said, "that's a pretty powerful gun." He said, "That's going to kick you real hard." So he said, "In order to make it easy on yourself, hold it about an inch ahead of your shoulder." He said, "It won't bother you as much." So I said, "Like this?" He said, "Yeah, that's right. That's just about right." And he said, "Remember this, Pete." He said, "It's a double barrel shotgun." And he said, "If you shoot one barrel at a time, it'll twist you." He said, "Pull both triggers at the same time." So when I fired, I don't remember much. I was trying to hang on to shingles. But boys, I lay up there, and sometimes at night, I can still hear the metallic thumping of that old LaSalle V-12. I really can. I can just kind of hear that metallic thumping. We looked down here. We had a shotgun road. Had to come in, turn around, and go out. Here came this black Mariah with the spare wheels and the wells, you know. Boy, beautiful old thing. Bulletproof glass on the back. Here came those 3 thugs in it. We learned to memorize their faces. Dad said, "Now they'll turn around before they shoot." He said, "When they hit the first pergola, you boys just raise over the roof. And when I say now, shoot right in the middle of that car. Be about as far with a shotgun, I suppose, maybe from here to the very back of this auditorium and another 20 feet. So you make a pretty good cone." And they turned that thing around and sped up. And as they just hit the first pergola, which are these big old stands where you turn the car into the driveway, Dad said, "Now," and we raised up and shot, and I flew. But my brothers used to talk about how that fella had that bulletproof glass pushed one here in his face against it, and this Browning machine gun on the outside, he was ready to just flip a bunch of shells at us. And his hands just went to pieces. And that gun hit the ground. Dad took the firing pin out. We played cops and robbers with that for years till somebody swiped it. We never heard from those people again. That's what we had to do, protect our house. Dad went through one after another crisis with these men. They tried to kidnap me 8 or 9 times, I was told. I can remember some, not all. We had to, before we ever went to kindergarten, we had to jump a blackberry vine. Now, any of you know how high they are? They come up about like that, right? That's a blackberry vine. You take a kid just a little older than he is, he's going to go to kindergarten, got to jump a blackberry vine. You say, "A kid that big can't jump a blackberry vine." Yes, you can. When your dad takes a bullwhip and takes a piece of hide out, you can jump the blackberry vine. You go head first, take a few briars with you. After a while, you learn to just go head first and tumble, head first and tumble. Why? Because all the way from home to school were Cam Kinoshita's blackberry vines, all the way down. And we'd walk as a family, 4 boys, after my brother Bill went to Caltech, 4 of us boys would walk home, and this old black Mariah would come by, and these boys say, "Aren't you the Shuler boys?" My brother Jack, who was the smart acre in our family, you know, he'd say, "Yeah, we were the last time we checked, you know." He'd say, "Well, get in, boys, I'll give you a ride home." Jack would say, you know, and then we'd run. We'd run down those blackberry vines. They'd get out, those old fellas sitting in an office all day, get out and they'd run, you know, and we'd just hurdle and run, hang them up on a blackberry vine. We'd go home and say, well, we hung some more up. Dad would say, don't get caught, boys. If you ever get caught, they'll silence me. That's the kind of a life I lived. And I lived that life, listen to me, it was an exciting life. Talk about the untouchables. I lived in the days. The only time any of us ever got hurt, it's an amazing story, but it's true. Ed and I were standing out feeding rabbits one night on the farm, and they came by just to harass us, and Ed waved his hand and said, you guys couldn't hit the broadside of a barn, and they shot him through the hand with a .45. That's the closest we ever came to really getting hurt. We always used to take mulberries. You know what they are? Take mulberries, and we'd wipe them on our hands or on our legs and put a little blade of grass on them. And run into Mom and say, Mom, where are you? Mom said, come over here quick now. Let's wash that off. And she'd say, you scoundrel, you know. And she'd hit us. This particular day, Ed came in and said, I just shot. She says, fine, go get a Band-Aid and put on. Cried wolf too many times. Now, in this kind of an existence, in this kind of a family, I was born the last of 9 children, 7 of which lived. Boy, Mom said I was the happiest kid she had. Just happy as if I had good sense. Laughed, joked, giggled. When I was 5 and a half years of age, I had an accident. Now, some of you are wondering what's wrong with me. I fell out of a barn loft and lit on my head, and that should explain all my idiosyncrasies, and I want some apologies out of some of you people when the service is over, what you've been saying about me. Ed and I got in a fight. I'm not going to get into it. It's too long. I don't have the time for it tonight. But Ed and I got in a fight, which was nothing new. We fought about every other day. Not that we didn't like each other. We were just curious to see who could whip the other. And we got into a bad one this time. So Mother sent us up to the barn loft to wait for Dad to come home, which spelt capital punishment in our house. You say, why? Well, when Dad got us on the ground, he couldn't hurt us much. Because Dad never figured out how to whip his kids with a switch on the ground. He'd grab us by the wrist so we couldn't get away, and he'd hit us and we'd run. Which turned him around and around and around. And about the third time around, Dad was whipping his own leg, you know. And he's dizzy, and so he'd say, let's sit down and rest a while. And while we're resting, he got over his little mad, you see. But when he got us up in the barn loft, we're on alfalfa dust. And you can run all day on alfalfa dust, but you don't go anywhere. And he can kill you. I won't mean to. It's just that people who have ever had any problem usually pick it up with me again. I go to some churches. I go to one in Rochester, Minnesota. Now, this is a good friend of mine, Dave Earnhardt. And he says, Phil, please, let Marie talk to me while you're here. Don't talk to me. He says, I stammer for a month when you're gone. I get up and say, over the ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba- couldn't talk when I woke up. And I went through an experience of 1 year. I was almost six when I went to kindergarten because my birthday is December the 29th. You have to be December 2 to make it on that year. And I couldn't go, so I was a year late. And when I went to school, I had a little note pinned to my lapel. And it said, "Dear teacher, this is Phil Schuler. And he cannot speak due to an accident. Please do not ask him to recite. Signed, Mrs. Schuler." And she said, "Son, don't take that note off your lapel. Let the teacher take that note off your lapel." So I got on the bus. I was head and shoulders above everybody else. And these little boys saw me get on the bus. One of them goes, "He can't remember his name." Another one says, "He can't remember where he lives." I remembered both. Made me mad. So I disobeyed my mother, took the note off, put it in my pocket, sat there and said to myself, "Remember to give the teacher a note. Remember to give the teacher a note. Remember to give the teacher a note." We stopped to pick up some kids. "Remember to give..." Patty Patterson got on, redhead, 5 years old, pretty as a speckled pup. Harvey Patterson's sister. And Harvey was Ed's best friend, but I want her to be my best friend. And I went, hoo-hoo-hoo. She said, oh, here, Carol, you can't talk. You broke your back. I'll go to take you to class. I've been there before. You carry my books. I'm just, she just started talking. I sat there and went, hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo. Forgot all about that note. Got in the class, sat in the last row. Teacher got up and said, now we're all going to give our names, put them on the blackboard here, and get acquainted today. I didn't hear. I was giggling at Patty. Pretty soon, I saw some kids in front of me getting up doing something I couldn't do. I couldn't give her my name unless she had 5 minutes to struggle through with it. And so when it came to Patty, Patty got up and said, my name is Patty Patterson. Teacher turned around to write it up there, and I just slid off my chair and lay on the floor under the chair in front of me. Teacher turned around. Patty, wasn't there a big curly-headed boy by you? She went, all right, kid, get up, she said. Always have a wise one in every class. What's your name? I got up, took the paper. I went, she said, I don't want your paper. What's your name? She said, come on, kid, don't you know your name? Well, it was my fault. I disobeyed my mother. So I put my fingernails deep into the palms of my hand. I tried the best I could. I said, some kid went, I went, pop! And some girl laughed, and Patty just straightened her right up in the back row. And Patty Patterson and I, that little redhead gal, took on the last row, and we whipped the last row, brother. Yeah, I remember my first day in kindergarten. You bet I do. Old Frank Wright, the superintendent of schools, after the war was over, and he saw me walking the streets, he ran up and his cane was a-bobbing, and he said, oh, Phil, he hugged me, that dear old Christian man. He hugged me and he said, oh, Phil, he said, I'm so glad that God spared you. And then he reached back and he said, son, it might interest you to know that you and Patty Patterson still hold the record for Columbia Grade School for being the only two that went home from kindergarten the first day in the back seat of the truant officer's car. Yeah, I remember my first day in school, and I remember almost every day in school. Mother said I fought twice a week, almost three times a week over my speech. I can't remember not getting in a battle over my speech. You see, it isn't that I didn't like kids. It's that the worst enemies that kids have are kids their own age. The people that hurt you the most are kids your own age. Girls, look up here. You're not going to be hurt by your parents. You're not going to be hurt by some little brother and sister. You're going to be hurt by one of your friends, your girlfriends, that lie about you and say something evil about you and break your heart because you want them to like you. The most cruel people to children are children. Did you know that? That is. They just, you know, it's like a sick bird with other birds. Other birds want to peck it to death. They don't want that bird to live. It isn't that they come and say, here's some first aid. Here's, you know, take an aspirin. They just peck it to death until it's dead. They don't want a sick bird around. And as I go through school, they just kept after me and kept after me and kept after me and kept after me. Until finally, I couldn't speak. I learned that I could communicate with my fist. And I'd smack one of these guys in the nose, and he'd sit down, and he'd run. And the next day when I'd come to school, he'd say, how do you do, sir? So I became a bully. What is a bully? A bully is a kid with an inferiority complex that tries to whip it with a superiority complex. He's usually a kid that's not like others. He's either a big fat tub of lard, or he's got birthmarks on his face, or he's got some impediment. And kids laugh at him, so he beats them up. He's bigger than they are. That's what I became. I began to hit kids and beat them up. And when I went home, I had to tell by way of a little note that Mr. Wright put on my lapel whether or not I'd been fighting. Now, Dad usually didn't have to be told that. I know it's been broken three times, and all my teeth are mine. They're still there, but they've been reinforced a little bit by gristle around them. From scar tissue, I had all my teeth come through my lips one time or another, and I've been fighting. And Dad would just look at me, and he'd know I was fighting. But if I was whipped at school for doing something wrong, Dad would give me lick for lick when I got home. He stood behind those who disciplined in school. Don't you wish they'd do that today? That'd be wonderful, wouldn't it? Now they come and fight you, try to take you to court. But Dad would say, whatever my son got at school, I give him lick for lick when he gets home. And then Dad would stop me when I come in, you know, a little bit of puff on my face. He'd say, "You've been fighting, son?" Never occurred to me to lie. It never occurred to me to lie to Dad on a thing like that. I'd nod my head. He'd say, "All right, son, did you start it?" And most of the times I did. They'd heckle me and I'd hit him. I'd nod my head. He'd whip me. He'd say, "I won't have a boy that starts a fight." Then when he got through whipping me and I was sitting there, you know, cooling off, he'd say, "Now, did you finish it?" And if I didn't finish it, he'd whip me the second time. And many the time, listen, many the time, that the Mexicans, those were the fighters in my day. I don't know about it today, but the Mexicans in El Monte were pretty good country fighters. And many the time, a Mexican would have me down for the third time, and I'd seen three or four of them. I knew I wasn't going to make it with this guy. He's too big. I'd get up, and he'd cock his hand to let me have a fourth one. And I'd use my little acting ability. I'd look over his shoulder. I'd go, he'd turn around to see who's about to hit him. I'd go, wham! I'd slug him on the side of the head and run all the way home so that I could get rid of that second whipping. I didn't want to get that second whipping. I had to finish it. Now, in that kind of a condition, I found Christ as my Savior. I was 14 and a half years of age. I've never smoked a cigarette, never touched one, never touched a drop of liquor unless it was in a prescription, never taken God's name in vain. I thought I was such a good little boy that I didn't need any salvation. Of course, I had a temper that wouldn't quit. But my dad was up preaching on Romans 3 and 23 and Romans 10, 9 and 10 and say, listen, he pounded away at that stake of truth, all of sin, all of sin, all of sin, until finally it got through my thick cranium that I was a sinner. I went forward and received Christ as my Savior. Still stammered. Still couldn't talk. But I knew I was saved for two reasons. Number one, God's Word said so, and I've been taught by the time I was a little kid to understand the English language that God's Word was true. So it never occurred to me to doubt that. God's Word said I was a new creature in Christ Jesus. I was saved. I believed it. Secondly, I didn't have a temper anymore. Honestly, I didn't. I'd go to school. Everybody knew me by this time. And I'd walk by, you know, and I'd go, wave at him. Guy'd say, look out, it's a trap. He's trying to get you close to him. Don't get close to him. It was a long time to convince those kids that I was a different person. It was a year after I was saved, almost to the month. My brother Jack had been saved back at Bob Jones College. Came back to preach. He's preaching his first revival meeting under the sponsorship of my dad's church. My dad had a tent down on Washington Boulevard. And we were having a revival meeting. Bob preached one night. Jack preached one night. It was the second Tuesday night. I was sitting at the back where the songbooks were. Jack let me pass out the songbooks for him. And Jack got up to preach. I don't remember his sermon. Really don't. I don't remember his text. I remember the theme of it. The full-time service, the call into full-time service. And he made a statement in the very preliminary of that service. He hadn't gotten 3 to 4 minutes into his introduction. And he made a mistake. He put the climactic statement in the beginning. You shouldn't do that. He said, say, listen, if God Almighty calls you into full-time service and you're willing to go, then it's up to God to prepare you for that full-time service. Did you hear that? When God calls you into His field of service, and you're willing, say, here am I, Lord, I'm willing to go. It's not up to you, it's up to God to send you to the school of His choice and prepare you for that full-time service. I was sitting at the very back. Now, no joke, Jack hadn't been speaking 3 minutes. And when Jack said that, the Lord just impressed me, Phil, I want you to preach. So I got up, right down that sawdust tray. Everybody went right to the altar. Jack blew his mind. He couldn't think of another word to say. He went, thaw. Thaw. He looked down his notes and they were all doing the Watusi, you know. He went, thaw. He said, Dad, that's a dirty trick. Dad said, now, son, you've lost your congregation. Close your service. He said, I haven't even started. He said, well, you've lost your congregation. Close your service. So Jack said, well, I'm going to go down and pray with Pete. He said, Dad, will you have the invitation? Dad said, all right, you go pray with Phil. Jack got down there on the other side of that altar. He grabbed me by the tie. He jerked me off my knees, nose to nose. He said, in the name of common sense, Pete, what got into you to do a fool thing like that? You ruined me tonight. And you got to have a little sense of humor for this part of the message. I'm half hung. I can't talk. I'm fishing for my little pad of paper that I carried all the time and a little pencil. I finally get it out and I write, I am called to preach. So, Jack said, yeah, you're called to preach. But he said, why did you have to come? Wait a minute. Called to preach. He says, yeah. He said, pray like a fiend. I'll be right back. Jack, get up here. Dad was saying, now there should be others. Come forward.
What's that, Jack?
What? Bob. Yes, sir. Take the invitation. Yes, sir. Jack and Dad got up here. Bastard. Now, you thought somebody had deceased in the family. I'm down here listening to this. Dad had 68 young people calling to full-time service under his ministry at Trinity Church. Now, that's a heritage, brother. That's reproducing after your kind. That's in the ministry. He was proud of every one of them. You know what he said? He turned to Jack and he said, Jack, you talked him into it. You get down on your knees and talk him out of it. God never called a boy to preach that can't answer the door and can't answer the phone, has to write on a blackboard, scribbles his hand away. That's why some of you people can't understand what I write when I write in your Bibles. I just don't have a hand anymore. I can print, but I can't write. I've thrown it away, writing all my life. Jack got down there till 10 o'clock. He did the best he could. But I knew God called me to preach all the way home, 23 miles. We rode in that old Buick, and I was a rose between two thorns in the back seat. Dad's on one side, and Jack is on the other, and I was in the middle. Bob was driving. Jack would say, my father would say, now, son, listen, it's not a disgrace to be a farmer. God needs farmers. I'll sign the farm over lock, stock, and barrel if you'll just say you'll be a farmer. And I'd write down there, but I'm called to preach, and he'd study that for a while. Jack would say, now, Pete, you're handy with a monkey wrench. God needs mechanics that'll tighten up nuts for Jesus. Be a mechanic for Jesus. And I said, I can't. I'm called to preach. Jack, you study that for a while. Pretty soon I was out of paper, so I was speechless. I just sat there. Now, I'm German, and you probably won't hear this among very many people, but this is the way I was raised, so excuse me if you don't mind. Dad used to say to us boys, it's a sign of weakness for a German boy to cry, for any boy to cry. He'd say, leave that to the girls. God gave them us a great supply of tears. He said, boys, don't cry. Boys, take it like a man. Been a long time, you know, except in those old board meetings we used to have. Long time since I shed tears. I was 15 and a half years of age. I was about 6 feet tall. I weighed 180 pounds. Football player. I went upstairs, straight as a die. Opened my door, got inside, closed my door, and threw myself on the bed and bawled my eyes out. It was the hardest one experience I've ever gone through, and I thank God for every second of it. Dad went into Mom and Dad's room, and I heard through the wall, Dad say, Mother, we had a tragedy tonight. Mom said, oh, one of the boys hurt? No, Phil came forward and an invitation and wrote on a piece of paper that he felt that God had called him to preach. Mother said, glory! Now, she's the emotional one in our family. Glory, she said. Oh, she started clapping. Oh, Daddy, isn't God good? Three preacher boys. Dad said, get a hold of yourself, woman. He said, I didn't say Bill. I said, Bill. She said, so? He said, so he can't speak. He can't talk. And the only time I ever heard my mother speak up to my father was on that one occasion. That's the gospel truth. Never did Mom and Dad disagree over punishment. We didn't know. There was no soft touch in our family. Kids know where the soft touch is. We had none. The only time I ever heard my mother speak up to my father was on that occasion. And though I cherish the thought someday of coming back to this church, and I might lose that opportunity, because what mother said was rated strictly X, I think I'm still going to tell you what she said. Are you ready for a shot? Now get a hold of yourself. She said, hush, sir. You talk about woman's lib. That's the harshest thing my mother ever said, I think. Hush, sir. She said, who is it that says before his people every Sunday that God can do anything but fail? Bob Shuler. Who is it that says behind every commandment of God he places his omnipotence? Bob Shuler. Now she said, Bob Shuler, don't you think that if God called our boy to preach, he could take care of his lips? Dad hit the leather chair. She said, now I've got to go in and retrieve what's left of that kid. And oh man, I jumped up. I've been crying. I rubbed my eyes real hard, picked up my Bible upside down, pretend to read. Have you ever done that? Mother came in and said, honey, Daddy told me what happened. I'm so thrilled. She said, don't lie to me now. Did God really call you to preach tonight, or did Daddy call you to preach? Or did your brothers, or your grandfather, great-grandfather, for whom you were named, do you feel you have to carry on the generations? I knew what she meant. I picked up a piece of paper, which is my inheritance to my oldest daughter. And I wrote on it G-O-D, God, underlined it twice. I knew that God called me to preach. She said, now, that's wonderful. She said, let me encourage you. And she's taking us now to our text. Exodus 4, verse 10. This is the second excuse of Moses at the burning bush. And Moses said to the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither heretofore, nor since thou hast spoken unto thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue. And the Lord said unto him, who hath made man's mouth? Or who maketh the dumb, or the deaf, or the seeing, or the blind? Have not I the Lord? Now mother stopped and said, now honey, Moses' problem was his speech. And God said, who's made the mouth that gives the speech? I have. Now get this last verse. Now therefore, go, and I will be with thy mouth and teach thee what thou shalt say. Brother, let me tell you something. Mother used to say, I hope my baby never gets too big to sit on mama's lap. I like to broke both of her legs that night. I grabbed her in a caress and almost jerked her neck out of place. What? She had become an angel to me. She gave me a verse from the lips of God himself that verified what Jack had just told me from the pulpit a few hours before. And look at me, I say it with judgment day honesty. From that incident in my life, I've never doubted God once. Not once. I have waited impatiently sometimes, but I've never doubted that God would answer. And God would do it. Now I close. Leland Whitaker, our youth director, the best I ever came across. And probably, he didn't have a lick of sense. Not a brain in his head. He never did think, he just reacted. And he always reacted right. Leland Whitaker called me the next day, on a Wednesday. Mother got on the upstairs phone. A stammerer can talk if he's asked questions. You don't have to use your lips. Or a stammerer can sing. I used to sit at the table and say, please pass the bread, you know. I'd sing. One way you could get it out. So mother got on the upstairs phone in case there were questions that had to be answered. And Leland said, hey, Phil, I hear you calling a priest. I said, uh-huh. He said, listen, we're having Hollywood Press over with their kids, and ours will have 1,000 teenagers there. 6 o'clock for Epworth League. How would you like to preach your first sermon to them? I said, uh-huh. He said, I'll put the ads in the paper. Dad came in when he found out that I had taken that speaking engagement. Had I a piece of chalk, I could have marked the ceiling where he hit it. Boy, he got me in his room and he said, son, don't do this to me. He said, William Randolph Hearst knows that I've got a stammering boy at home and he knows his name is Phil. He'll send a reporter down there. When you stumble and fall on your face, he'll come back and put in the headline, Shuler's idiot son follows his daddy in the ministry. He laughed me out of this time. I said, you understand that? Well, boy, I felt sorry for Dad because that's a bad spot to put your daddy. I nodded my head. He said, what do you want me to do? I wrote down on a piece of paper, this is my daughter Julie's inheritance. Help me write a sermon. And thank God he did. And I memorized it. And that Sunday night with my dad sitting behind 1,000 kids, Leland read my scripture. And I got up and opened my mouth for the first time in 10 years, and I could hardly wait to get there because I knew God called me to preach. And brother, it just flowed out. It was high and husky and sounded like a girl's voice. It hadn't quite turned into a girl's voice, but it was something. And I didn't know it was me speaking until I looked out and saw 1,000 flycatchers, you know. And then I got happy, and I got rid of Dad's sermon in 5 minutes, and I remembered a little of all of Dad's illustrations, and I began to give them, and I began to pace, and I began to try to modulate my voice. And it was 55 minutes later that my dad, the first time I ever saw him weep, was that night. He stood with a handkerchief, tears running down his face, waving and saying, son, son, I'm convinced you're called to preach. You're 10 minutes in my evening service. Close it down. And I've been running off the mouth ever since. Some kids asked me some time ago, couldn't you do something else? You boxed, you wrestled, you played some football. Oh, maybe a year, two, three, until the big ones came by and ate me up. But I'll tell you this right now, I could never do anything successfully except that which God calls me to do. He called me to preach. And that's why, for some of your information, when you come by and ask me why I don't take more rest in my schedule, I can't do it. Because God gave a boy that couldn't talk for 10 years a speech. And I'm not about to waste that for any vacations, for any idle time. I'll keep preaching till Jesus comes after me. But don't you think, ladies and gentlemen, and boys and girls especially, don't you think that if God can take a stammering, stuttering, idiotic boy and call him to
to preach and make an evangelist out of him and see over 80,000 souls saved under his ministry so far, don't you think that God can take normal people and use them too? I do. Would you bow your heads and close your eyes, please?